Okay. Amazing. Today is Monday, April 27th, 2020. And once again, due to the miracles of modern technology, we can do more than they did 100 years ago during the previous plague. Again, I want to thank Morty. I want to thank my granddaughter for helping me, because when it comes to the computer, I am Amharic. I hope in other matters I'm not such a big Amharic, but with the computer, yes. I want to say good morning to the wonderful faces in front of me and people whose names I see, but without faces, including Rabbi Rubin, and to all those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence. I just want to mention, before I begin the heart of the lecture, I received an interesting question from my dear student, Rabbi Yehoshua Grunstein, and he had heard that Reb Blazer Silva permitted counting of the Omer before the Plag HaMincha. Well, basically, it seems impossible to me. I try to check if anyone discusses. There's a big discussion after the Plag, if you count, if you say Kriyat Shema, if you Yotzei, Halacha L'maaseh, David, we say that after the Plag, you have to count again after real Seif HaKachodim, but without a bracha. It could be b'dieved, you are Yotzei. But before the Plag, now I know there was a whole discussion by Rav Asher Weiss about candle lighting before the Plag. So I tried to see what I could find, and very interestingly, I found an Eved LeYisrael. Are you familiar with Eved LeYisrael? Eved LeYisrael was a sefer that Rabbi Yosef Elihanken wrote to raise money for Ezra's Torah. And it was a very popular sefer. Every shul and every rav bought it. It's Rav Henkin, his thinking, halachic, on davening, on the festivals, on benching, on how to teach children. Rav Henkin had a very unique mind. And interestingly, I found on page 136 that he says, with Sfirat HaOmer, you should wait till Seif HaKachavim, but b'dieved, even if you count after Plag, then you count again at night without a bracha. However, im shofar kodem Plag HaMincha, yachzov yispar b'layla b'brachas. Okay, you see clearly that if someone counted the Sfira today at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and made a bracha, he still is obligated to count that night and make a bracha again. The bracha he made in the afternoon was basically a bracha lebatala. So I don't think anyone in the world would permit counting before the Plag. Anyway, Rav Yehoshua checked it out, and he reached a rabbi who had been in Cincinnati, where Reb Blazer had been rabbi, as you know. And the story was that Reb Blazer permitted an old age home, a senior citizens residence, where they davened early, people go to sleep. I know myself, I go to sleep earlier than I did years ago. All right, on the other hand, I wake up early, I don't have to apologize yet. There, he permitted them to count after the Plag. Then shuls, evidently, the problem that you see all over the world, it goes back to Germany. Charlie, this was widespread in Germany, you should know, where they davened, let's say, all winter, all summer long at 7 o'clock. Why? People didn't want to go out at night. It was hard, the physical reasons, perhaps safety. This carried over to America. I remember this in my youth. And there, Reb Blazer permitted, if they're going to have an early minyan after the Plag, these minyanim were after the Plag. Many times they daven Mincha and Maariv together. That's a separate question. But there you yotzei daven Sfira. But it wasn't that he said you could count before the Plag. Now, the question of lighting candles and can you make Kiddush and the whole question, the Plag. I'll tell you, Rav Asher Weiss was made killed by candles, but the evidence, if you light before the Plag, you yotzei. I can understand that. I'll tell you why. Candles is a din in Kavod HaShabbos. So you're lighting 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the Kavod Shabbat. All right, before the plug, but when Shabbat comes, you're going to have kibud v'oneg, the candles will be there. However, Kiddush is a din in Shabbat. It has to be nighttime, all right? We're mekil after the plug, according to some Rishonim, Tosfos, the whole sugya in Bracha, it can be considered nighttime already. So you can make Kiddush, but you can't make Kiddush before the plug. That's talui in the reality of Shabbos. It's not something you're doing l'kavod Shabbos, einik Shabbos, that Shabbos should begin with the candles lit, but that has to be part of Shabbos. Anyway, I'm just answering the question because unfortunately I don't have Sherry at my side, and I wanted Rabbi Yoshua to know that's my thinking. Then I want to tell you a second matter that brought me great joy. You all know the Azraeli family. The Azraeli family survived the Holocaust, made it to Israel. David Azraeli served in the IDF. And after Mohammed HaShikhrur left Israel, wound up in Canada. And let's put it very mildly, we wouldn't exactly call him a millionaire, a multi-millionaire, probably by today's standards, Baruch Hashem, a billionaire. But what's most important, he never forgot his roots. The tzedakah that the man has done, the business in Israel, the Azraeli malls, every mall with a shul in it, and every store in the mall that serves food has to be kosher and Shomer Shabbat, kol hakavod. The Azraeli graduate school, Yeshiva University. What you don't know is he also has a little publishing house that publishes memoirs of survivors. He is a survivor, and anyone who writes a memoir, he will publish it. I picked up a little volume, where I xeroxed this in the volume, The Wail of Tears by Rabbi Pinchas Hirschgrun. This is the great Rabbi Hirschgrun of Montreal. And this Rabbi Hirschgrun, who, you know, could his son-in-law happens to be my student, Sal Newman. And I hope, Sal, I hope your wife is having a refuah shleima. She was quite ill with the coronavirus. And Rabbi Hirschgrun, photographic memory, I heard this from endless people who put a pin in the Gemara, and he would tell you exactly where the pin fell on each daf. And I heard this from Edi Riyah. This is not anecdotal. So he wrote a memoir about 2 years of his life, how he ran away from Hitler, the miracles. And believe it or not, I found a written source now. I don't have to say Rakepit is quoting an anecdote. Rakepit is quoting an interview that was recorded years ago. I'm quoting Rav Pinchas Hirschgrun, a written source. And what is the source? I'm sitting here only because Yeshiva boys from Mir didn't listen to Das Torah. This is one of the biggest problems. Anyone raised in Beis Yaakov or raised in Agudas circles, this is one of the biggest theological problems they have. When you dialogue with them, they cannot talk their way out of this problem. Had my Rebbe, Reb Chenech Fishman, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, listen to Rav Chaim Moshe Grishinsky, I wouldn't be sitting here. Who knows, I'd be working, volunteering in a hospital. I would have become a medical doctor, rock science, all that goes with it. We don't have to elaborate. They didn't listen. No, the story is told. And now I call Rav Pinchas Hirschgrun. He was from Yachal, Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. He was Hasidic. He had students who gathered around him in Vilna, where they ran to escape the Nazis, and they thought they could escape the Russians, that little period that Vilna was independent. No, they went to Rav Chaim Moshe about 48 hours before his death, and they asked Rav Chaim and Eitza, they can go to Kovna, they can get the simple Sugihara visa, Curacao they had, go to Japan, etc. You all know the story, what to do. And Rav Chaim Moshe told them, shave the alta aser adi, quoting word by word from the memoir. And they walked out, they looked at each other, and the students And Reb Pinchas Hirschsprung knew me and the het apsak from a litvish gadol. We just heard what a litvish gadol paskin or the mir zayin chassidim. Where chassidim? Min davton andrish. We have to do the opposite. And if he paskin not to go, we have to go. They went, they got the visas, they came back to Vilna. Reb Chaim Moisach died, and the rest is history. But I now have a written source. I was so happy. You have no idea. And this is not a source from a bee venom, you know, Plony Almoni. This is Reb Pinchas Hirschsprung, Zecher Tzaddik, Kadosh Lebracha. All right. Finally, going back to previous lectures about Rabbi David Hollander. So my dear student, Rabbi Steve Przemski, dear Rebbe, I enjoyed immensely the discussion of David Hollander's Zatzal. He was exactly as you describe him. I add only one point, as I got to know him very well in the late 1990s and 2000s. He was one of the leading activists against the Oslo Accord and the American rabbinate. We worked together on many initiatives, and he, almost 50 years older than me, had more energy than I had. And he goes on and on describing Rav David Hollander. So Baruch Hashem, we did a little something to bring his memory back to the fore. All right, now let me pick up. We're discussing the organization of the Rabbinical Council of America. You all know the Agudas Rabbanim, had they taken in the American rabbis, there would have been no RCA. But the Rabbanim felt they were Lamdanim from Europe, these American Yinglacha, who knows how much they know how to learn. We don't take in second-rate guys. There's the big leagues and the minor leagues. Where the big leagues, they're the minor leagues. All right, this is what they felt. Reb Lazer was caught in the middle. His own children went to YU, what is today YU. He was caught in the middle. There were others caught in the middle, but this was the dominant opinion. As a result, nature abhors a vacuum. RCA begins 1935, slowly but surely, more and more rabbis. And now you have a halachic commission. You talk about the halachic commission, and they had graduates of Yeshiva Tzvi Chochanim, graduates of Chicago, the Hebrew Theological College. And some of these young men went on to brilliant, brilliant careers in the rabbinate. Some of them became Lamdanim Mupakim. Before I get involved with the Simcha Levi, who's the heart of today's shir, we spoke about him at length last time, I want to go back to two names that I mentioned in passing, or one that I certainly mentioned in passing and one that I will mention. I just want to say a few words because these people deserve to be remembered, and maybe there's a young man looking for a doctorate. One of the most fascinating rabbonim in the early years of RCA, a member of the Halachic Commission, was Rabbi Simon Dolgin, D-O-L-G-I-N. Rabbi Dolgin was a graduate. He was not a YU person. He was a graduate of Chicago, and he was a dignified rav who his achievements was second to none. If you talk about the United States of America, what are the three most important shuls? There's no machloket. The three most important shuls in the United States are Rabbi Lukstein Shul, Kilat Yeshurin, Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and the third one, Beth Jacob Congregation of Beverly Hills, California. Rabbi Dolgin is the man who built Beth Jacob. He began as rabbi in the early years, 1938 already. He was rabbi of a shul, West Adams Jewish Community in Los Angeles. The shul is either called conservative or semi-orthodox, the usual story, no mechitza. At a later date, he moved the shul to Beverly Hills and built a block long, it's a major, major edifice, a strictly Orthodox shul. I need not tell you, you attracted there in Beverly Hills, ultimately, when you say Baruch Hu, you're saying Baruch Hu with billions of dollars bowing alongside of you. No different than KJ, no different than Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Right across the street is a major, major day school that I believe it's called Hillel Academy. Right after the Six-Day War, maybe a year or two after we came in Aliyah, we came 69, he came 71, went to Ramat Eshkol, and he was officially the Rav of Ramat Eshkol. Until today, there's a square outside the synagogue, which he built in Ramat Eshkol, which also was called a branch of the Beverly Hills Synagogue Beth Jacob. The square is named in memory of Rabbi Seidel. And this was an individual, a number one prestige, love for Yiddishkeit. Really proud to say that I knew him. A man worth doing a doctorate on his life. Another person is a name that perhaps it's more well known today because of not all the stuff he published are known, but one is particularly well known, as you'll see, was Gershon Appel, A-P-P-E-L. Reb Gershon Appel, he was a YU graduate. He was the last person to get smicha from Rabbi Rebel, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, right before, this is 1940, right before Rabbi Rebel and Reb Moshe died. The last person to get smicha. And he went on to, Baruch Hashem, lived a long life and died in 2008, I believe well into his 90s. Let's see if I have, 1916 to 2008. Now, what's fascinating around Rav Gershon Appel, he was excellent in two worlds, halacha and in machshava. The world of halacha, he was a member of the RCA on the halachic commission. He wrote a volume which still circulates. It has been reprinted, has been expanded. I believe it's his grandson who did the work. Some of you may have held this volume in your hands, The Concise Code of Jewish Law. It's based upon the Kitzah Shulchan Aruch in English, and he takes the Kitzah and expands it into modern times. It is really a fabulous work. A revised edition edited on, it's a Talmud of mine. He was in the Kollel, Rabbi Daniel Goldstein, lives in Israel. And I believe it's a grandson. I can be corrected. Maybe it's not a family member. Maybe it's a great grandson. But I believe he's a grandson. And he did a beautiful job in reissuing it. It's a volume of Finding the Grist-based Medrash. That was one aspect of Rabbi Gershon Appel. The other aspect had tremendous interest in machshava. Did a doctorate at Bernard Revel, afterwards a doctorate at Harvard, two doctorates, worked on Sefer HaNiyah, which was a halachic sefer that was called Sefer HaNiyah because it was published on a paper. It wasn't published on parchment. It was like innovative, so they called it Sefer HaNiyah. Later worked on Sefer HaChinuch, worked under Professor Wolfson at Harvard. Rabbi Belkin introduced him to Professor Wolfson, and he became so enamored of Professor Wolfson, who also, you all know, is a fascinating story. This is the Rebbe of Isidore Twersky, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, the Rav's son-in-law, That's your world, Jay. And he became very close to Wolfson, and they learned together. Wolfson do a doctorate under me, did a doctorate under him as well. Was in long, varied rabbinic career. It wasn't like Rabbi Dolgin, who was Mr. Los Angeles. When Rabbi Dolgin left, not so simple. No rabbi remained totally identified until today. Rabbi Norman Lamb's brother, Maurice Lamb. Rabbi Maurice Lamb was rabbi, then Rabbi Avner Weiss. There were a number of rabbanim that succeeded Rabbi Dolgin, but Dolgin was there many decades. He could have remained indefinitely. Went in Aliyah. Rabbi Appel went. He was in Seattle for about 10 years. He was in Worcester, Massachusetts. He later was in Kew Gardens. But his love was scholarship. And later he taught at Stern College and in the Judaic studies at NYU. So hello to the Weinstein family, filled out with everyone there. And he was a fabulous individual who also plays a major role in the Halachic Commission. Nothing could be passed, could be discussed without his input. He was a Talmud Chacham Mufak. Okay. Now, the big question we were dealing with before the break was a problem today. It's hard to comprehend this. We have other problems, but this was the problem of the microphone in the synagogue. Why did they want a microphone? First of all, you can have rabbis like Rakefet have weak voices. Some people are blessed. Did you ever hear Rabbi Haskell Lookstein speak? Rabbi Haskell Lookstein has a built-in microphone to the fifth power. You can have 2,000 people sitting there. Everyone will hear Rabbi Lookstein. Other people have weak voices. But let me be honest, Mark, this was not the reason they wanted a microphone. No, who grew up in the 30s, the 40s, the Jews loved Chazanim. And Chazanim, shul supported themselves. Do you remember the Homach Leikit? And I remember yet as a kid in the Bronx, they bring in a big chazan, they pay the guy $2,000. $2,000 70 years ago. How do you get the money? Everyone had to buy a ticket to shul. No, Shabbos morning, how did they know you had a ticket? There was no Arabs, you can't carry. You had a bindle, like you get at the Kever Rachel, a bindle. How do you say that in English? A rubber band, a bindle. You put around your hand like this, and the rabbanim, it was a homach leikis, but they were matir. You wear it, you came to shul, you showed the bindle, you were allowed in. Now, if you pay $2,000, $2 to hear a chazan that's getting played too, that you want to hear him. You want a microphone. So the microphone became a tremendous issue. And Reb Simcha Levy, who was a YU graduate, I told you, a London Mufak, we ended off talking about a little of his life, the mismach of the early years, Rabbi Revel, and spoken learning with the Meshita and with Meshach Soloveitchik. This man, he permitted a microphone. And in Baltimore, with all due respects to Baltimore today, if they write the history of Torah in Baltimore, they have to write that Baltimore, all the major shuls had microphones. Now, I told you that for us in Gruss, it's really hitting home because the name I mentioned a few minutes ago, Sherry Levy, she is the married to the great nephew of Rav Simcha Levy, Benji Levy. Sherry's husband is a great nephew of Rav Simcha Levy. His grandfather and Rav Simcha Levy were brothers. So this hits home. This is Rav Simcha Levy's sefer, Simchat HaLevi. It's a regular sefer, regular tshuvot, very fascinating. But when you open it up, right in the middle, do you see? English. What is this about? I'm quoting from page Lamed Bet, Leiv, Tshuva Chaf Vav, B'inyan Shimush B'Microphone B'Shabbat B'Yom Tov. And the letter is from I. Allen Mitchell. You know, these people who use their middle name, not their first name. Jewish, I don't know. Mitchell doesn't sound like a Jewish name, but anything is possible. It's from United Transformer Company, 150 Varick Street, New York 13, New York. Shiv is dated January 9th, or the correspondence is dated January 9th, 1952. Dear Rabbi Levy, this is to confirm the conversation we had today regarding the operation of a public address amplifier. Public address amplifiers, as they are manufactured at the present time, employ a microphone which is connected to the input of an amplifier, the output of this amplifier going to a loud speaker. A small level of sound impressed across the microphone is amplified by the electronic device so that a high level of power comes out of the loudspeaker. The electricity consumed from the line by the amplifier is constant and bears no relationship to the use of the microphone. The electricity is employed in the amplifier in two ways. One, it lights the filament of the vacuum tubes. I don't want to read it all, etc. Two, the second use of power in the plate circuits of the vacuum tubes. The second use of power is in the plate circuits of the vacuum tubes. And he goes further. In other words, the amount of electricity consumed from the line or in the apparatus does not vary in any way whether the microphone is in use or not. And you see what he's saying here, and this is expert testimony. It's uman lo moral nafshei. It's a basic principle that a professional will not do anything to harm his reputation. So you have to accept this letter as being totally valid. And what are we being told here? That once the microphone is turned on before Shabbat or a time clock turns it on, when you speak, your voice does not change the amount of electricity that's being engendered, that's being utilized. This is the way I understand it as a lay person, could be a physicist, would be able to comprehend it a lot deeper. But Reb Simcha Levy goes on in the tshuva and he says, there's less of a shaila here than a frigidaire. And if you recall, and you know the rabbinic literature out of the 20s into the 30s, I would say without exaggeration, tens of thousands of amudim were written. Can you use a Frigidaire? Can't you use a Frigidaire? With the Frigidaire, the problem is much stronger because it's not like a microphone where the electricity level, according to this tshuva, remains constant. But with a Frigidaire, you open the door. The more you open the door, hot air comes in. The more hot air comes in, the thermostat kicks off the motor, etc., etc. And Reb Simcha Levy says, if the matir of Frigidaire, alachat kama v'kama, we can be matir a microphone. Okay? This is the tshuva. You can look at it in depth. It's fascinating. I imagine it's available on Hebrew books. But I want to show you something else. Reb Simcha Levy was so well known that there's another shaila that came up. And what's fascinating is my Talmud, the Jacob Sasson, Rabbi Jacob Sasson, who I believe is an actuary as far as Panassa, he went through the Herzog archives. Some of you know, I showed you other documents that were discovered that have caused a tremendous discussion, pro, con, the documents between Mayor Kahana and President Herzog remains an unresolved mystery. I agree wholeheartedly that it's not the Rav's Hebrew. Someone wrote the letter. The question I ask is, what happened to President Herzog's response? How come we only have it in the Herzog's archives, but it doesn't show up in YU? If we know who, how did someone get the correspondence, take it away, it was addressed to the Rav. How could someone write in the Rav's name? All right, that's a different Shaila. We're living at the time of Yemot HaMashiach, Chutzpah Yazgah, so that's possible. But it's an interesting question. But my dear Talmud Jacob Sassoon discovered correspondence between Rabbi Levy and Chief Rabbi Herzog. An entire handwritten letter, then a typed correspondence, and on what topic? And here too, it's fascinating. Tzitzit being made by machine. It seems that during this period, rayon came on the market. If I'm not mistaken, it's not wool, it's not linen. And there's a whole description here how it's made. It's artificial. And it turned out that it could be very easily turned into tzitzit for taliyot, for taliyot, for avakanfis, etc. And how is it being done? By machine. The whole process, how it's made, everything by machine. Well, if everything is by machine, don't you need l'shem mitzvah tzitzit? And once again, you have that same haunting question. Can you create a lishma by humans who are pressing a button? Baruch atah Adonai Melech Olam Shekolim Vav. Can you create a lishma by humans who are pressing a button? And here, and this holds over, it's not just by making tzitzit. What about shmura matzah? The whole question of shmura matzah, the same mitzvah matzah. And here, the whole matzah, just press one button, and the 100,000 shmura matzah will be made that day. So this question, fascinating, but fascinating that Rabbi Levy was such an authority that Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac HaLevi Herzog turned to him. And he was matir that it's no different than any other lishma. As long as the human being initiates it, this is lishma. I need not tell you that problem remains questionable until today. And all of you know that in Israel, there was recently a scandal. Here, by and large, people didn't accept it when it came to tzitzit. Tzitzit have to be made properly. Tzitzit have to be done properly, put together properly. You cannot just use a machine. So you recall what happened a few months ago. It turned out that part of the taliyot and abakanfet we're buying with tzitzit, with alach hechsherim, they're being put together by criminals in jail. In jail, you have to find work. So in some of the jails, that's what they call a Mador Dati. I guess you can call it a Mador Dati Charedi, a Machlakat Dati Charedit. And if someone is a Shomer Shabbos, he's sitting in jail, whatever the crime is. I don't want to exaggerate, but let's hope it's only a white-collar crime, all right? Who chazah b'tshuva is a Shomer Shabbos. He can make a living in jail putting tzitzit together. And this was in the newspapers, Lekan Ulekan, we'll leave it that way. But this is Rabbi Simcha Levy. This is the Simcha Talmidei. Now, this issue became a cause for Lebra. And there are two reasons why. One reason is essentially the right wing attacked them. They were not willing to accept this. This was considered, wow, you're coming out chutzpah. Who are you? You're not Lamdanim, you're not Gedolei Yisrael. Who gave you the right to discuss this issue? And on the other hand, within RCA itself, people lack confidence. And this takes us back to a question that I've heard my dear neighbor and friend, Dr. Sam Dershowitz, many times we have discussed this issue. And you think about it, I'm throwing it out. I'm looking at a group of people in front of me, I'm seeing faces that by looking at them, we can absolutely tell that you are in the YU spectrum, call it the modern Orthodox world, call it what the Rakefet calls Torah Jews in Western civilization. All right, how do I know it? I look at the Rebbe teaching. Take a look. Is this a Rebbe? Is this a Talmud Chacham? How can it be? Kippah Shmukar, an Israeli flag in back of him, a striped shirt. I look, there's Jay with a Boston baseball cap, Kala Kavod. I don't know how you know baseball exists anymore, but I also have a New York cap right behind me in the closet. Tell me, do you have a feeling that, you know, I'm a good Jew, but I'm not the best. I look at that Haredi individual, that Haredi Rav, that Haredi Rosh Yeshiva. He's better than me. He's smarter than me. He's firmer than me. He governs with more kavana than me. He knows how to learn that. You have that feeling, you know, all right. No, you answer the question. It's a legitimate question. If you know yours truly, fortunately or unfortunately, I'm a chutzpah. I don't have that feeling. Anyone who can learn better than me, I'll kiss his fingernails, no matter what he looks like. And if he can't learn better than me, I'll be very nice to him as a decent human being. I mean, Makabel, I call it number, save upon him. Yafot, but the chlatz of Christ, thus haste the Talmud Chacham. Don't want to translate. Let it hold over. So, all right, there's a delicate question. Rabbi Gershon Appel got up at one of the meetings of the Vat Halacha. You know, who are we to decide these questions? With all due respect to Rav Simcha Levi and the other members of the commission, we have here Gedolei Yisrael, the famous Rabbanim of the United States, people, Smicha from Europe, and this was a major issue. And RCA basically was caught in the middle. Now, many of the Rabbanim, there was a Rabbi in Baltimore, Rabbi Samuel Rosenblatt, knew you all should recognize the name. He was the son of Rabbi Yisrael Rosenblatt. I believe he was a graduate of JTS, but he was 100% frum and a Talmud Chacham and a top quality rabbi. And he corresponded with Rabbi Leventhal of Philadelphia, Rabbi Lazar Silver, Cincinnati. And they both wrote to him that they could see no reason why you can't use a microphone. They accepted Rabbi Simcha Levi. They accepted the answer he got from the microphone company. And they were willing to be someich on him. Now, even Rav Henkin, and Rav Henkin is very important because you've heard this many times already. Rav Henkin was the posek of America before Rav Moshe, everyone, including a guy named Donnie Rothkopf in his first year in the rabbinate, when he had a difficult shayla, you turned to Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin himself, it seems from his writings, he too would have been matia, but he couldn't come out publicly. He asked them, please don't quote me. Why? He was involved in fundraising. I told you this, Ezra Steira. He couldn't afford to take a stand. He had to be persona grata to the right and to the center and to the left. So this issue hung fire. Let me quote to you from Jewish opinion. This is the organ at that time of the publication of the Agudas Yisrael. This is before Jewish Observer. Quoting, Torah Jews therefore can only view with the greatest alarm and dismay the attempt of the Rabbinical Council of America, comprising graduates of several American yeshiva, you know, between the lines. What do they know? Who are they? Eisfats who went to yeshivas from Chochanan to Chicago, does Heistechet the yeshiva, close the parentheses. graduates of several American yeshiva to nullify this ban by issuing a circular letter permitting the use of a microphone in an Orthodox synagogue on Shabbos. And this was just indicative of what was going on. Now, RCA stood its ground. They publicly sent around a letter to anyone who asked, quoting Reb Simcha Levi, permitting the use of a microphone. But believe it or not, by 52, by 53, it all came to an end. Why? Mori Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, was moving sideways. You will know, here's a man raised in a home that was anti-Agudat Yisrael. We're talking anti-Agudat Yisrael. Reb Chaim Riska. And Mori Rebbe became an Agudist. And now already he's honorary president of the Mizrahi of the United States. In a few years, he's going to deliver the epic making Kol Dodi Dofeik. If Eli is sitting there, part of it is because Kol Dodi Dofeik. If I'm sitting here, Kol Dodi Dofeik. David moving sideways. He's not only gone from Agudat to Mizrahi, Agudat Harabonim, he's now in RCA. RCA brings him in, votes him in, honorary membership, doesn't have to pay any dues. Dove, you were a member of RCA, have you paid dues? I haven't paid dues in years, but in the rabbinate, of course I paid dues. RCA, Rabbinical Council, we had to bring letters of recommendation. They only took you at the end of the year after Smicha to be sure you're legitimate. And the Rav coming into RCA, willy-nilly, they forced him to become chairman of the Rabbinical Commission. And with that, Mori Rebbe comes out against the microphone. Once the Rav came out against the microphone, no one could say boo. And this will explain to you why you do not find a microphone in the famous Orthodox shuls that are comprised of modern people, the type who were in Baltimore in the 40s. No microphone. And goes back to the Rav's psak. You're not going to find the microphone. Am I correct? Morty, when were you last in Baltimore? I don't believe any Orthodox Jew. Am I right? There may be one that perhaps has a microphone. But outside of that, I don't believe there are any in Baltimore.
I don't want to say anything, but I think there is.
One. Yeah, I know which one. I know which one. I'm sure it is. It's all right. That yes, I'm going to smoke. But once the Rav Paskin. Now, I just want to tell you in parentheses, does this have any relevance today to the Tzomet microphone? The answer is absolutely not. The Tzomet microphone is way beyond this type of microphone. It's totally different. Again, if I had a physicist sitting next to me, he would explain it. It was developed for the Israeli Navy. Anyone who served in the Navy knows you can't be on a ship without a microphone, a loudspeaker system working. That's the way you can give orders, you can give commands, the ship can function, the ship can travel, the ship can do what it has to do. Under Rabbi Gorin's aegis, a microphone, a whole system was developed. Tzomet took it further, and they have now perfected it for shuls. It has to be, it's a very expensive system. It has to be built for the shul. It has to be taken to configuration, the shul, how it is. And I cannot tell you how many snifim they put together. The microphone is covered, you don't see it. It cannot be touched, it cannot be tampered with. There's no inyan like a kli shir shemi yitakein. And it just one after another. button, some with microphone, but that becomes a political question. Not halachic. Halachically, its sound is way above a frigidaire. But politically, what can I tell you? A rabbi in Florida, I got up to speak there Shabbos morning, 900 people there. Anyone sitting beyond the first 10 rows can't hear. And not only me, even it's a community of senior citizens, basically, although other people live there too. And I told the rabbi, put in a tzomet microphone. So he's shaking, you know, mayom ruhan goyim, what will the other rabbi say? And he comes from the right-wing world. So I told him, you have the easiest answer in the world. The median age of your congregation is 90 plus. In order for them to hear, you need a microphone. No one in the world will argue with you. But this was the issue of the microphone. So it's interesting. Reb Simcha Levi wrote one of the few shuvot, I would imagine, that were ever published with an English letter in the middle, but his opinion ultimately dissolved itself. The Rav was opposed. Why was the Rav opposed? We don't have a shuvot. I imagine halachically was chayshish for the electricity and sparks and what it creates. And there's a whole chazonish on this. There's a whole literature. There's a masham shvadran. I'm sure he was, at the most, the Rav held that was perhaps a suffix he should be a writer. But that was enough for him to asa. Politically, it could be. He also had other considerations at the conservative temples, etc. But I can tell you this had a lot of implication. I'll tell you one little side story, then I want to come back to RCA. But I there's a fellow in London, it's been a student of mine for many, many years, very fine individual. And his father was a Rav, a Chashuv Rav. And the shul, and this goes back to the 60s, I believe, put in a microphone against his will. And they told him that Rav Unterman was matir, and he refused to go along with it. And he contacted the Rav, and he knew that the Rav's attitude was negative, and he resigned from the rabbinate. And his son told me he never found himself again, that all his life he taught, he did this. He was never the same person. He was cut out to be a pulpit rabbi. And over that microphone, he gave up the shtela, and never really found himself all the remaining years of his life. And it's a bit of a sad story, but all right, life has a lot of curveballs, and there's a lot of hashgacha pratit, and hakol toli b'mazal, afilu sefer Torah shebehechal. Let me go a drop further. I see my granddaughter made me hot tea here for my voice, kol hakavod.
Rebbe, you could talk a lot softer. We're hearing you very loud.
I can't. However, I could talk soft. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Lori. Let me go a step further. Another shaila that came up, which again, you don't have today. You might have it in South Africa, might have it in Australia. You don't have it. The whole situation in America is different. But that is the late Friday night service. The conservative temples, and we spoke about this, hopped on very easily. Late Friday night, people don't get home from work. We'll accommodate them. And if Shabbos began at 4:30, they had a service in the temple at 6 o'clock. All right, can you do this in an Orthodox shul? And remember, in many Orthodox shuls, this moment in time, the majority of people worked Friday, got home late. I told you, the Bronx, I had my own building, my own father, my own neighbors. There was no concept of surrender to halacha. It's like, it's a madrega to be able to be Shomer Shabbos. Rabbi Nathan Tarrigan would understand me very well more. But the concept of surrender, it didn't exist, never. So, accommodate them. This is a real problem. Halacha l'maisa, the Kabbalat Shabbat service has to be at Lichtenstein. Later in the evening, you can work out what we call an Oneg Shabbat. Don't sanctify it with a formal davening. You can have an onik Shabbat. You can sing a little lechadodi. You can sing some zmirah. The rabbi can give a sermon, which is basically what they came for, to hear the rabbi speak. But don't sanctify it with a service. You cannot introduce a late Friday night evening service. Underline the evening. But you can call it a non-egg Shabbat, dignity of Sabbath, and this could on in many Orthodox shuls. I told you, in South Africa, I had the experience with the Chabad shul, where the service began 4:30, and it ran until 6 o'clock when it really became barchu. And it stalled off. There was mincha, the rabbi taught, they sang lechadodi, then they introduced the guest speaker who came all the way from Yerushalayim. And by the time I got up to speak at 5:30, 5:45, the shul was filling up. What began with 12 and a half people, you now had a few hundred people. And I saw that in Australia. And I told you, down the block, when I was there 20 years ago, they're organizing a new shul. I said, we need a shul. You have a shul down the block. Zechabad v'zechabad. No. That Chabad rabbi compromises. Why should we first start eating Friday night at 10 o'clock, at 9 o'clock at night, at 8 o'clock at night, when Shabbos begins at 4:30? All right, I understand it. A problem that haunted RCA, haunts us until today, haunts us, the chief rabbinate, haunts us on the religious situation in Israel. Conversion for the sake of marriage. And here again, I can't repeat everything I said. It's not only yesterday, it probably was about 40 years ago in the Kollel, I devoted over a year to the conversion process. It's a very fascinating topic. Those of you who have studied conversion, there's practically nothing in the Gemara, a few daf in Yevama, a daf in Bechora. That's the whole conversion process in the Gemara. The halacha, to simanim, whatever, Shulchan Aruch, Yaradeya, it never was a problem. Why wasn't it a problem? Anyone to convert to Judaism was risking his life. If you wanted to convert, you literally were risking your life. You all know the Vilna Gaon, Shvuot coming, the famous Ger Tzedek, and this was no conversion. You don't risk your life. Modern times, I think next to the Aguna problem, more has been written on conversion than any other problem. Perhaps Aguna's number one, conversion number two, civil marriage number three. Now, in modern life, anyone can convert. No one's going to execute you for converting. And here the problem is much deeper, because you're converting to marry a Jewish man. The Jewish man himself is not Shomer Shabbos. So you're converting to be like your husband. The man is converting to be like his wife. This is a very basic problem. More than that, the whole conversion, l'shem kedushin, is l'shem davar acher. Perhaps a conversion like that doesn't count. The conversion has to be l'shem shemayim totally, not for personal benefit of some sort. Halacha l'maisa, we paskin bisman hazeh. I don't think there's a posik in the world who will not allow a conversion, even if it is for marriage, as long as there is proper observance. And excuse me. And here's where you have to give Soha credit. I attended one of their classes in Tel Aviv a few years ago. A student of mine running it, Rabbi Constantine, a real Constantine, a graduate of the Kollel. And I attended a class where his father spoke, a Holocaust survivor. And it was an unbelievable experience. Everyone there coming to convert had to come with the person they want to marry. Half the people were converts to be, half the people were Jewish, and their success rate was excellent. I cannot tell you 100%, but it was excellent. And that's the way to do it. Here in America, you have another part of the problem that hangs over your head, and this is what is being discussed here in Rabbi Bernstein's volume. If the Orthodox rabbi won't convert them, they'll go to a Reform rabbi. The Reform will have no problem, and you wind up having endless Jews who never had a formal, proper conversion, and no one will know that in America you move around. You go community to community, coast to coast. I know someone grew up Jewish. Later in life, she finds out she wasn't Jewish. Her mother was converted by a Reform rabbi. She became observant. She had to go through another conversion. I know one person who went through two different conversions at least, could be three. One conversion was back in Oregon, and it was an Orthodox rabbi of a conservative shul. She came to Israel, got caught up in the Merkaz Harav crowd. No, an Orthodox rabbi, conservative shul, how Orthodox can he be? She went through another conversion. So you see, this haunts us. Well, Rabbi Levy, and here there was the unanimous feeling, yes, we should do our best. We have to encourage. We have to teach. But due to the exigencies of the circumstances, we have to rely upon the lenient opinions, and you can convert. However, the RCA says you have to have a court of three rabbis. Now, anyone knows you don't require rabbis for conversion. You require a Beis Din. A Beis Din has to be knowledgeable Jews. They have to know what they're doing. You don't exactly need a court of three rabbis. But you're talking about the United States. You're talking 1950s, 1960s. Where are you going to find knowledgeable Jews? At least if you say three rabbis, these three rabbis will be knowledgeable Jews. And this is what they paskin. You have to teach, do what you can. It doesn't say that they makabel all the, you know, the problem we have. Are they makabel all the mitzvot? Are they shomer Shabbos? All right, Rav Kefet is giving endless lectures. I once gave a lecture on this topic in front of a big Talmud Chacham in America, in Flatbush, and he kissed me. My lecture, I showed this is the only topic where Rav Moshe Feinstein changes his mind. In Europe, he would have thrown out any conversion with his not total shmirat mitzvah. He says, in America, I won't convert, but I don't rebuke my colleagues. And he gives an unbelievable svara. I can't go into all the detail now, but Gaev ben Akum, the Gemara in Tal Gadol, he says, when a person converts, they convert what they think Judaism to be. Hamid Gaev ben Akum didn't know that there was Shabbos. The textbook was missing the pages on Shabbat. So today, a person converts. Who are the famous Jews? Bibi Netanyahu. No, I want to ask you, did Bibi daven a Lagishmon Esrei this morning? I hope so, but I'm far from certain. Famous Jews, Shimon Peres, Yitzchak Rabin, David Ben-Gurion, Chaim Weizmann. Who heard of Rabbi Lichtenstein? His Yotzeit was yesterday. Who heard of Rabbi Asaf Bednash, Rabbi David Miller? Famous Jews, that's what they're converting. They're no different. All right, there's a tremendous difference. When you're born into the club, you have membership, whether you pay the dues or not. But to become a member of the club, you have to pay the dues, obviously. But this is such a nutty, difficult problem. You all know what's going on in Israel, what's going on with Chaim Drukman. It hurts us until today. Are there solutions? There is absolutely no perfect solution. But I like what Soha does. I have to say, to run classes and bring the other party and assign them to a religious family, they should see Shabbat, they should see Kashrut, and I hope they see how a husband and wife get along. You understand? It's a very difficult world today, with sex is meaningless. People get married here. I don't know why Makori Shon has an article on a family where they live. Well, now they have it this week, an article on a family. They were living together 10 years before they got married. Why do we have to publicize that? But this is the kids today. You get married when you want to have children. God's a love hidden. There was once a world where sex and marriage were one and the same. And then you have, well, one person said to me, either couples are divorced today or they hate each other. Ribbono shel Olam, I don't hate my wife. Far from it. Morty, I can testify you have no enmity towards your wife. You understand? And I can go further. Baruch Hashem. And let them see happy marriages. But I don't know. People tell me that they're throwing dishes at each other. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong, but I would like to think my students, my colleagues, my friends, my acquaintances, 99% of us are not throwing dishes at each other. But even looking at the screen here, I know I'm not totally right. Okay. But do the best you can. On the other hand, a person converts. This was the story that made the rounds in Israel and all the newspapers. I hope it's anecdotal. Mark, I would hate to think it's true. But people tell me I'm naive that it is true. What was the story? This lady converted, Kadatva Kadin, with a real Beit Din and a real this and a real that and Kabbalah Mitzvah, and she is Shomeret Mitzvah. And then one of the Rabbanim on the Beit Din met her in the supermarket in pants, and he had the Beit Din invalidate her conversion. I hope that's not true, but people swear to me, Rebbe, you're naive, it really happened. God so uphidden, that's how you invalidate a conversion. That's what we're talking about. I hate to tell you this, but let me be intellectually honest. And in the early 70s, Moriu Rebbe committed pantsuits at Stern College. No, yes or no? You remember or you don't remember? As long as it's sneistic. Rabbi Avadja Paskin Lahalacha, Bifneyam Vieda. If a girl is going to wear a tight skirt and a tight this, better she should wear pants that can be more sneistic. No? You can't pass aloud, Baruch Hashem. My granddaughter doesn't wear pants. I can tell you better. I once asked my granddaughter, she's sitting here opposite me. I asked her years ago, she won't remember, I remember. I said, well, what are you going to do when you graduate high school? Share it with me or Ami? She looked at me. I said, Ami, like her grandfather's the biggest, shakiest ice wash pushback in the world that I even mentioned that a girl can do Ami. But Ribbono shel Olam. All right, a little bit psycho. All right, let me move on. These are very fascinating questions. This is America. This is what happened. The issue that haunted the RCA, the Rabbinic Commission, the issue they could never really solve was, of course, mixing. Halacha l'maisa, the RCA was 1,100% against mixed seating. The Rav was, you know, publicly all his decorations. On the other hand, many Rabbanim had mixed pews, and many Rabbanim, if you take Rabbi Riskin, the Rav, and then Rabbi Belkin ordered him to take Lincoln Square, maybe you can change them. You know the whole story, I don't want to go into it, but I lived the story. Lincoln Square began with a group of Balabatim intellectuals, well-to-do, on the Upper West Side, and they wanted something different, something with meaning, and they were unhappy with the conservative temple. So they organized, and they're going to be conservative, but they want something that will be more meaningful and speak to them. So they turned to Yeshiva University. So Rabbi Riskin went to the Rav. The Rav told him absolutely not. And 1 week later, the Rav calls him back. I'm ready, but you told me no. I was testing your spiritual tenacity. I think what happened during the week is Rav Shmuel Belkin got hold of the Rav and said, you know, burrow the way they spoke to each other. Don't you understand? And get at Yiddish. They spoke Yiddish. And he said, what this can do for YU when no one can succeed better than Riskin. The Rav told him, give it a try. And you got to give the boy wonder, as they called him, Steve, credit. He wasn't the rabbi, wouldn't take a salary. He was educational director, I think was his title. He davened elsewhere. Then he came in, he spoke, he led, he this. Within a year, they took him on, put in a small mechitza, and as they say, the rest is history. Today, it's a mainstream, big Orthodox shul with a mechitza kedafik. So RCA was always caught in a quagmire with the mechitza. The problem is non-existent today. Even Shira Chadasha, even Drisha, their innovative minion, even where the women are davening for the Yomer and the women are laying the Torah and the women are doing this, the women are doing that, but they still have a mechitza. You go in, you'll see a mechitza right down the middle. It's unbelievable. The Yom Kodesh is flat, is both sides. Everything else, the table they read on, both sides, the shulchan. But a mechitza they have, without a mechitza, it's not a shul, okay. As far as that goes, the concept of the mechitza went out. However, there were other problems that came up in a shul, and there's one problem. Boy, do I remember it. Charlie, maybe you remember, Vic, the older people here, youngsters compared to the Rebbe, but you all should be, bingo in the synagogue. Do you remember what went on with that? Bingo. The churches all had bingo. Shuls and churches always had a fundraising problem. And people left to gamble. There was no better way, no easier way. People go to the movies, they pay. People spend the night out playing bingo. They're willing to put down $2 to get into the temple, to get in Lahavdil, the church. Can you have bingo in the synagogue? So I want you, I remember this so vividly. Halacha l'maisa, what finally came out of it, and this is both an RCA and both the Agudas HaRabbanim, lachatchila, absolutely not. Gambling, not desirable. But then you'll get a Talmud Chacham who once learned in his youth that he'll say, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin says it's only if that's your panasa, but it's only a sideline, a little entertainment. Mesachek b'kuvya, you're not pasul v'yedah. It's only if that's your soul panasa. So if you're going to have it in the synagogue, in the social hall, not in the synagogue proper. And that's the way endless synagogues, I can still see the signs. Bingo, every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. I can still see the signs in front of my eyes. Lahavdil, churches, everyone was doing it. I don't know today if this would come up already. I don't know if the Jews would, the Mahjong, do all the ladies play Mahjong today? Bingo, it's a different mentality. But wow, the RCA had to deal with this in and out, the 50s, the 60s. When I was in the rabbinate, remember it like yesterday. Another problem which again haunted the RCA. Here, Louisville, Kentucky, quotes the whole story. I know some of the people involved. You had two big Orthodox shuls. They shared a shochet, they shared shochetim. Remember, this is before empire. Again, I'm talking to a generation. Do you remember the machlekes? I'll quote words to you. Shchutei chutz. Remember those words? I still remember Philadelphia. They wouldn't allow empire in. Why? The shechtim will lose their jobs. Shchutei chutz. This is an old rabbinic concept you'll see in Shelet and Shabbat, that if you had a shtetl with two shechtim, no other sheikh to come in from outside. They have to preserve their panasa. So today it's a different world. Today there's no such thing as local sheikhdom. Today you take the big companies, they shed millions and millions of chickens a year, frozen, sold all over the world, kashered, frozen. It's beyond words. The revolution that was engendered by Empire Kosher, Hendara, Pennsylvania. I have students who are sheikhim there, and they all get along. You have sheikhim there, YU graduates, Satmar graduates, Lubavitch people. Suddenly there's no machloket. And they have standards. They don't overwork. They don't get tired. All the problems with shkita, they have respite. They have their own shul, their own community. Kol hakavod. But here you have two shuls, and one shul, the Balabatim vote, as they did all over the United States, to take the mechitza down. And here's this poor sheikhet, his side income is he's a cantor in the shul, and now they take the mechitza down. He doesn't leave. He's getting $10,000 a year, gets another $10,000 for shrita. He's making a decent living. He has kids in New York and Yeshiva University. I mean, imagine yourself. And the other shul, the rabbi is furious, says he cannot be a sheiched because he's davening Shabbos in his shul with mixed seating. Chotev umachti et harabim. And the other shul says, our sheikh is a tzaddik. We want him as a chazan. We're the sinners, but don't interfere with his panasa. No, sounds familiar or not. And you can give endless variations. Look into Rebbe, look into Silva. I can tell you endless variations of the shayla. And our CA here is caught in a quagmire because 25% of your rabbis at that time members are rabbis and shuls with mixed seating. Either they're in there to change it, either they're in there because the shul changed on them and they didn't want to walk away, whatever the reasons are. All right, this issue went back and forth, but RCA had no choice. They came out publicly that the rabbi is absolutely correct, that if a sheikhed is the chazan in a shul with mixed pews, he cannot be considered reliable as far as shkita goes. We don't know what happened. It could be the sheikhet gave up the job as chazan, or the shul just gave him extra work in addition to being chazan. He should also teach the children Talmud Torah. He had to stop shkita. But these were questions that came up time and again and put the RCA right in the middle of a terrific dilemma, unfidera, one or the other, 20% of your abanim, 30% of your abanim. This was all over the United States. You even talk, I remember like yesterday, the Concourse Center of Israel, a bastion of Orthodoxy, Shmirat Shabbat, on the concourse, there was no mechitza. They didn't have separate seating. They didn't have mixed seating. They had separate seating, but there was no mechitza. And to Rabbi Berman, every rabbi there was a JTS graduate. Shurim Shabbos, 100%. But JTS, Solomon Schechter, Historic Judaism, I spoke with some of them. I knew the way they thought. Orthoprax, absolutely. Orthodox, very questionable. But this was America. This was the situation. Go to page 49. Of Louis Bernstein's book. And here again, you see what's happened in the last 70 years. Riding to shul on Shabbat. And this already, David Hollander is president of RCA. And he makes a statement that's picked up by the Anglo-Jewish press all over the United States. David Hollander, as president of the Rabbinical Council, exhorted Jews not residing within walking distance of the synagogue to remain at home on the Sabbath and holidays rather than travel. And they quote him, although public worship is very important, it nevertheless does not absolve us from any of our commandments. All right, to us that's logical, that's axiomatic, that's Torah, Zilkri Berachu. Criticize all over the United States. And here, one of the papers that criticized him, the Intermountain Jewish News of Denver. And they boasted that no traditional rabbi in Denver repeated Rabbi Hollander's statement. My dear students, Intermountain Jewish News, can anyone tell me who is the editor-in-chief today? Who publishes it? Hillel Goldberg, Rabbi Dr. Hillel Goldberg, shtickel on a goodist. No question about it. Why you are good at Yisrael? A little bit to the right, perhaps we can say. That's the publisher of Intermountain Jewish News. The Forward reported that his call had no effect in Los Angeles, where one couldn't find parking space in the lots of Orthodox synagogues. All right, Beverly Hills, people don't drive up on Shabbos, I can testify. Young Israel on Wilshire Boulevard, Century City. I don't think there's one person. Place's mom, Beth Jacob, Endless Mignonne. What are we talking about? But 60, 70 years ago, that was America. That was the seminary. This is the time that the Tshuva Responsum was written, permitting driving to shul on Shabbos. Three rabbanim raised in Orthodox homes. Three rabbis. Their fathers were rabbanim, talmidei chachamim, gedolei Yisrael. Rabbi Adler's father, the founder of MTJ, Tiferet Yerushalayim, where Rabbi Moshe later succeeds him. And they were martyr. RCA stood its ground. But Louis Bernstein has an interesting comment here. Hollander was striving for the religious ideal while his critics were commenting on the contemporary scene. So very, very fascinating. Okay. Let me just go one step further because I have to clear the deck for Rabbi Bednash. One step further. One problem that RCA had that was not just RCA. This was a problem that goes internationally. Problem that more or less is with us until today, although there seems to have been to quote yesterday, Shir, a hitgapshut, the crystallization. And that is the problem of civil marriage. Civil marriage haunts us. Every youngster knows, you learn Masechet Kedushin, Ha'ish Niknat B'Shlosha D'Rachim B'Kesev B'Shtar U'B'Biyah. You could marry a woman one of three different ways. And one of the ways, one of the drachim, is sexual relations. Well, if this is the case, every civil marriage basically should create a regular marriage that needs a get to dissolve it. This is the heart of the problem. You'll say, but there were no witnesses. No, you all know the Gemara says if they're living together in one apartment 30 days, chazakah, hein hein eide yichud, hein hein eide bia. Chazakah ein adam osed bilato bilatzlo. You see them living together. They share an apartment. They share a mailbox. They share a bank account. They went and had a civil marriage. It also indicates they went through the trouble. Logically speaking, should absolutely create a marriage. Perhaps we can view it differently. Marriage is a halachic concept. if you didn't have chuppah v'kedushin and you weren't mekadesh the isha kedat u'kedin. So all it involves is prostitution. All right, you had a civil marriage. The woman didn't want to be with you unless you guaranteed her a home to live in and a bank account to be shared. Fine. But sanctity, halacha, who gets a hoot? Who cares about it? You'll tell someone, but your relationship is licentious? They'll laugh in your face. Clinton, president of the United States. That is our president. Donald Trump, president of the United States. JFK, who do we look up to? You know my book on Greek culture. Every year they complain to the Rav, why you require the kids in high school, they have to learn about the Greek mythology. Now the Rav would say, you don't understand contemporary civilization without understanding Greek mythology. Boy, do I understand the Rav's answer today. You read Greek mythology, the gods, they killed, they plundered, they robbed, they stole, they seduced, they murdered, they raped. Just like Allah, Elu Elohecha Yisrael, if the gods can do it, certainly the masses can do it. Not halacha, it's not. This is a very interesting machloket, not a simple machloket. I can bring proofs on either side. You all know on this too, I lectured for a year and a half or so. Who was the tremendous machloket in the United States? The East Side shook. Murray, if you recall the East Side, Vic, you recall the East Side. Reb Moshe and Reb Henkin lived about 2.5 blocks from each other. Am I right or wrong? 2.5 blocks, as I recall, something like that. Reb Henkin held civil marriage absolutely 100% requires a get. Did I say Reb Henkin? I hope so. Reb Moshe held, no, bidyavad. If you don't have a get, it never created a halachic marriage. She can walk away without a get. She can remarry. And the kids are not mamzerim. And I have to tell you, Reb Henkin didn't publish a great deal in his life. There are two volumes. I have them right over there in my bookcase. Kol Kitvei Rav Agoin Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. I would say 70% of those two volumes are dedicated to refuting Rav Moshe and showing that civil marriage absolutely, totally, completely requires a get. That's Rav Henkin. Rav Moshe came upon this Indian time and again and remained firm, didn't budge. Be the avad, you don't need a get. Now, you can understand the dilemma of the average rabbi in America in this 50s, 60s. Doesn't know what to do. He knows Rav Moshe. He knows Rav Henkin. He bows before both of them. He loves both of them. These were personalities, if you knew the Elichkeit, the humility, the Ibige Gebenkeit, the dedication. I'm proud that these hands shook the hands of both Rav Moshe and Rav Henkin. Believe me, I'm proud. What do you do? How do you paskin? More than that, if you know the response to literature, heard my lectures, the Dva Avraham, Rav Avram Dobek, Kahana Shapiro of Kovna. This was the Gon Shebagainim, the graduate of Elushin, the man who gave Moriu Rebbe Smicha and wrote about him that he has the spirit of his grandfather, Chaim. He didn't know what to do. He proposed, it was in the mid-30s. He said, a shayla like this affects everyone, every Jew alive. Because you're going to walk along, David, and you meet a girl and you want to marry, and then you find out her mother was married a second time and didn't have to get after the first marriage, which was civil, affects every Jew alive. Could you imagine Israel today with the millions that have come in from the United States and Russia? How many times the Shaila comes up in Russia? Everything was civil marriage. In America, it's how many Balei Tshuva we have? Tens of thousands? Go look, parents, where they were, the shilas I've seen over the generations. So the Rav Ham proposed we should have a convention of all the Rabbanim and let them decide this issue once and for all. Acharei Rabim Lahatot, as we said yesterday, as we will say next week. You know what the RCA advised the rabbis? Freedom of choice. We don't want a paskin. It's a tremendous machloket. You have your choice. You can follow Rav Moshe, you can follow Rav Henkin with all the implications. My dear students, what have we accomplished today? All right, first of all, I mentioned a few topics that really are not part of RCA, but are part of Aaron Rakefet's life at this moment in time. And above all, finding that source from Rav Hirschsprung, you cannot imagine how happy I was. Rakadati Meirov Simcha. Fabulous source. In writing. By the way, he wrote the memoir in Yiddish. It was published in Yiddish. And Azrieli Foundation paid to have it translated and footnoted beautifully into English. And I read the English volume, which I read English and Hebrew 1,000 times faster than I read Yiddish. And we came back to RCA, we dealt with the microphone, we dealt with Simcha Levi, we dealt with the Rav, we dealt with questions of the synagogue. Bingo, I don't believe the bingo question, which was so prominent when I was growing up, when I entered the rabbinate, I don't believe it's a major issue today. The other questions like Friday night services, but conversion, major issue. With us until today to the 100th power compared to what the question was 60, 70 years ago. Today it's much more difficult. There's a world that wants perfection in every conversion, and she's wearing pants, throw her out, etc., with all the implications. It's not a simple question. Civil marriage, here there's been every great posek from the Minchat Yitzchak, Reb Moshe, and all the others, Reb Avadya, we always try to get a get. If we can't get a get with the Eved, we will never declare the children from the second marriage Mamzerim. And even my Rebbe, I spoke with the Rebbe in 78, and I pressed him against the wall, and he agreed with me. I said, Rebbe, because he held that Henkin was right. He held it's the Rambam. I quote it from the Hilchot Ishah Perek Aleph. Take a look. That Matan Torah doesn't change the original concept. It just adds to it, sanctifies it. But he admitted that that's on an adultery, which of course is an Isur of Mitat Beitin, etc., Karet, etc. But when it comes to children remarrying, it's only a love, Mamzeret. There we can be Samach and Reb Moshe, we can be Mekil. Be'ezrat Hashem, next Sunday, I pick up exactly where I left off. I would not miss the shir for all the people who will be dancing on the streets on Sunday when the Seger and the blockade will be lifted. 9:30, as guided and directed by Professor Tarakin. Morty, are there any questions?
It's unmuted, everyone.
Any questions, anybody? Hey, Jack?
I want to mention that Rabbi Appel is Mishpacha. He's, you must remember Mayor Aron.
Of course, he was on the Foreign Service in Israel, Aronofsky, yeah.
Right. So. Rabbi Appel's wife was raised in the Aron household.
Wow.
Mrs. Appel, she and her siblings became orphans at a young age, and Mrs. Aronofsky took them into their household, and they were raised like siblings, even though it was a first cousin relationship.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Very close to the love of my mother-in-law.
And am I right that Rabbi Goldstein is a grandson or a great-grandson?
I have to check with Deborah about that.
Check it out.
Is he before Rabbi? Did he graduate with Rabbi Lam, or it's a generation before?
You're talking about Rabbi Appel?
Right.
I believe he's before Rabbi Lam. Why did we say that he was got the last smichus before Rabbi Lam? He was 10 years before, 8, 9 years before.
A contemporary okay.
Right. He was before. He was a contemporary of Rabbi Solomon Maimon, who was slightly younger, that era. But did I describe him correctly? Was a not just Talmud Chacham.